Powerful Radio is pleased to present Church of the Masses with award-winning Catholic columnist, screenwriter, and media consultant, Barbara Nicolosi.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Church of the Masses. I'm Barbara Nicolosi, coming to you from Virginia Beach, Virginia. I'm a professor at Regent University here in gorgeous Virginia. We're having beautiful, crisp fall day, not too cold at all, very nice. And my thing is to talk about the intersection of faith and culture. I'm a screenwriter, a member of the Writers Guild of America, and I am also a professor of cinema. Just ran upstairs from my classes on, we're talking about character with my freshmen this week. And the other thing we do is we interview people who are making culture. I want to encourage everybody in the church to stop cursing the darkness and instead start actually making beautiful things for the people of our time. So that's what we talk about here. We talk about anything that's of interest to people of faith that's in the culture. We'll be reviewing the movie Harriet later in the hour. Harriet is now in theaters, and just as a spoiler, I'm really high on the film. I think it's a great film, and I encourage everybody to go see it. But I'm going to be reviewing that with one of my students. So for now, right now, we're going to launch into the news of the day. Anything that would be of interest that caught my attention as a person of faith. And so, yeah, I think one thing I want to talk about is the success of Harriet at the box office. Very surprising to people in the culture, mainstream culture, that Harriet, CNN's headline says, despite all of its controversies, Harriet had a $12 million opening weekend from 2,000 theaters. And this is promising, it says, for a film that has been plagued with complaints from the beginning. And apparently the thing that people don't like that they're complaining about in the movie is that there is a black bounty hunter who is someone that is hired by the slave owner to track his own people and return them to the plantation. And so people are infuriated. How dare they show this? Huh? Well, they show it because it's part of history. It's true. And in fact, the slaves were sold into slavery by their own princes and kings and their own people from Africa. They made deals with the colonials to sell their own people. And so what the lesson is that I thought with Harriet, and we'll talk about it more, there are good black people and bad black people. There are heroic black people and cowardly black people. There are wonderful white people and there are evil white people. The message of the movie is that evil and goodness do not obey skin color. Huh? So I think it's great that the film did really well. And I love that the left, again, the American left, which is continually trying to redefine reality according to what they think things should be as opposed to what they really are, has been flummoxed yet again. So if you don't stay on to listen to the whole hour and the review, know that I am encouraging everyone to go see Harriet. I think it's a great film, and I think you will thank me for being told about it here. I'm fixing. There we go. That's better. Okay. The next thing I want to say, one of the things that happened when we were at the theater watching Harriet was the trailers, which went on and on and on, as they are wont to do. And we had 15 minutes of trailers. And my husband and I noticed that almost every trailer was for some kind of movie with some kind of political agenda. Now, this always does happen before an election year, right? Hollywood rolls out in time for an election year lots of movies that trumpet their particular leftward view. And this year is going to be no exception. There's a whole bunch. We were just kind of marveling at movie after movie was so clearly. So there's one coming out about DuPont, the chemical company people, evil corporate America poisoning people. It was looks to me like, what's that Julia Roberts movie, Only with Chemicals, you know? But anyway, whatever. And anyway, it kept going. But one that I noticed that I did want to bring up was this movie Bombshell. And so Bombshell is getting the full bore celebrity studio treatment. And it's the story of the women at Fox News and how they were being preyed upon by Roger Ailes, who was the head of Fox News. And so now you have Nicole Kidman, Margot Robbie, Charlize Theron, major stars in this depiction of what was going on at Fox News. And what was going on at Fox News was Roger Ailes was a little bit of a pig and would say salacious things and apparently proposition some of the women. And that's wrong and wicked and gross. But it's nowhere as gross and wrong and wicked as what Matt Lauer was doing at NBC, that Jeff Zucker, his boss, and everybody else working there knew that Matt Lauer had installed a button to lock doors so women would be stuck with him and he could then molest them and et cetera. It's nowhere near as wicked as what Harvey Weinstein was doing at Miramax for 30 years. 30 years, credibly accused of multiple rapes. But neither Matt Lauer nor Harvey Weinstein has a movie, a full-scale Hollywood production, to talk about what he's done to women. I just wanted to point that out. That once again, what you have here is the left defining the argument by what they're going to include and what they're not going to include. And this is why no one trusts the media anymore, right? Because they're not going to make a movie about Weinstein and Matt Lauer, but they're going to make a movie about pathetic Roger Ailes with his little, his little violations against the Me Too movement, which again are creepy and piggy. But he was doing basically what Joe Biden did on a weekly basis, you know, and now Biden gets to be a credible candidate for president. Whatever. So that's Bombshell. I'm sure it's going to be, you know, made a lot of as you go ahead. But I just thought that. Another thing that has come out, again, talk about media bias this week, was the story that just came out that Project Veritas blew the lid off of ABC News sitting on the Epstein story. So we owe so much to these people at Project Veritas. They are holding so many in the media and on the left accountable. They are unveiling things that the regular mainstream news will not reveal. So the story is that ABC News had all of the scoop of the Epstein matter 3 years ago. The reporter, her name is, let me see here, the anchor for ABC was Amy Robach. And they got her on a hot mic talking about with her frustration of how she had the whole story. She had all these connections of Prince Andrew going to Epstein's Island and Bill Clinton and that all these creepy people. It was all out there. They had everything, and ABC refused to go with the story. They would not run it. Well, I was like, well, why would they not run it? Well, think about it. 3 years ago was, let me see, 2018, 17, 2016. Oh, the presidential campaign. So this story that this woman had come out with, had discovered of the terrible things that Jeffrey Epstein was doing on his island of exploiting sexually young women, some underage. And Bill Clinton was someone who went there apparently many, many times. So ABC was not going to reveal that Bill Clinton was up to his old tricks again. So they sat on the story. And here's the thing. In so doing, they willfully allowed women to be raped, for this to continue, the exploitation, this pedophilia that was going on, the exploitation of women, vulnerable women. And these are the same people who wanted to skewer Judge Kavanaugh for something he may have done in high school 32 years ago. He may have done something. There was no credible accusation made except based on one woman's very, very, very weird memory. Huh? And yet ABC and the other news networks, they ran that story continually. Remember the 2 months of the Kavanaugh nightmare that we all went through? Now here you have a story where they had credible facts, depositions, information. She said they had it all. And ABC would not run it, allowing women to be molested and raped and exploited. So who's worse, Judge Kavanaugh or ABC News? Again, the interesting question is, where are we going to go with journalism in the future? We have absolutely no journalists right now in the mainstream. Huh? My husband and I have taken to watching OAN, One America News, because honestly, we don't know where else to go. But the fact that nobody trusts in the media is directly tied to this thing. Anyway, we have an amazing guest who's a physician, friend George Sarah, who's going to be on next time. We're closely to the Church of the Masses, the most powerful radio.
Welcome to our January 11th, 2020 Spiritual Warfare Conference. Every year without fail, this is our most popular, well-attended event. This year's Spiritual Warfare Conference will host Adam Bly, a Catholic demonologist and an auxiliary member of the International Association of Exorcists, along with Dr. Luis Sandoval, a psychiatrist who's part of the Healing, Deliverance, and Exorcism team for the Diocese of Orange. These two gentlemen bring tons of experience and expertise in the area of spiritual warfare. This is going to be a high-information Catholic seminar. I'll be there as well, sharing some riveting stories on the diabolical and liberation found through Jesus Christ from my best-selling book, The Devil in the City of Angels. Mark your calendars, come and join us, and meet other radio hosts from Jesus 911. Contrary to popular belief, spiritual warfare is not demon-centered. It's Christ-centered. Come join us and learn how to armor up and fight the good fight of faith. Catholics, wake up. Don't hit the snooze button. Join us at St. Christopher Catholic Church, 629 South Glendora Avenue, Escovina, California, on January 11, 2020. See you then. Strength and honor in Jesus' name.
His own image, male and female, he created them. According to Pope St. John the 23rd, it is not true that some human beings are by nature superior and others inferior. All human beings are equal in their natural dignity. May God help us to look upon everyone as a person created in his image and likeness, and treat everyone the same without favoritism or prejudice.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Church of the Masses with Barbara Nicolosi.
And hello again. Welcome back to Church of the Masses on the Virgin Most Powerful Radio Network. I'm very happy to have you join me. My name is Barbara Nicolosi. I'm a screenwriter. I'm a professor. I'm a very committed Catholic, and That kind of makes me a little bit of an oddity in the world, especially of radio, Catholic radio anyway. To my knowledge, nobody else does what we're doing here, and I'm very happy to do it every week, and I'm very grateful to Terry Barber and the people at Virgin Most Powerful Radio for inviting me to be part of this amazing thing they're doing, which is making media. So my guest today, one of the things I always do is have a guest who's actually making culture, who's putting beautiful things out there in the world. And so I'm really delighted to have this guest, and it's different. We haven't had a musician on up to now. So so welcome composer and musician George Serra. Hi, George. And hello, George. Is George there? Doesn't seem to be there. So anyway, hopefully George will call in. And they're not giving me any indication at all of where George is. But George is work. I will go through his bio and hopefully we'll get him back on in time to interview him. George is a very committed Catholic who came into the church after he had begun pursuing his career in music. He was part of a band that got some traction in eclectic circles, right? He's originally from Seoul, Korea, and moved to the United States at the age of 5 years old. His band, let me see if I can find the name of his band. Here we go. It was called Stereotaxic Device, right? And this got him some attention in the alternative music scene. George ended up being the band that was used on, part of the band that was used on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a television show that some of you will remember going back a few years ago. And then George met the creator of that show, Joss Whedon, and then he's kind of off then. So George has had an extensive career collaborating with the L.A. Master Chorale, with Morrissey, with, the Beijing Modern Dance Company. He's done music for the Olympics. He has done music for innumerable television shows. Part of the soundtrack, if you Google his name, George Serra, and you look at his kind of amazing list of credits, George is really working in the mainstream on shows from the NHL, and as diverse as the NHL promos on NBC to things that I saw on here that you would, crime scene, to CSI New York, et cetera. So History Detectives, Oprah Winfrey, Everwood, George has worked extensively creating music in a variety of formats. On top of this, I know that George has a great passion for a movie called The Passion of Joan of Arc by Carl Dreyer, which is reputed to be one of the greatest saint depictions that's ever been done. Really interesting story. And George wrote a new musical score for this film. This film goes back to the 1920s. It's one of the greatest classics of silent cinema. And so George took this film and rescored it. He's done that with a couple of silent pieces, but this one he has had quite a lot of success with traveling around, and they will do a concert with it. They will show the movie, and then they will play George's new score. Amazing man of many talents. And do we have George with us here, there yet? Yeah, he's there? No? Yes? Not yet. Okay, well, let me keep introducing him then. I first met George because we used to see him at the Latin Mass in L.A., at St. Therese in Alhambra. And if you're lucky and you go there, you can run into him. George became a friend of my husband and I, and he's been to our house many, many times. And we talk about trends in the arts and culture and in the church and in music. So I'm really intrigued to have George talk to us about his view of music right now, the music scene, music in the church and in the culture. You know, my opinion is that, and again, I haven't studied music, but I've always been very close to it. I have two sisters who have done work as professional musicians. I have one sister who's a professional opera singer, and music has been a big part of my life. And my feeling is that the general disarray in the arts, which comes back to the lack of detail, is affecting music the way it's affecting all of the arts, that we don't have a generation for a couple generations now that has been able to embrace the rigor and exigencies of creating beautiful stuff. What John Paul II called the demands of the beautiful, that these require isolation, reflection, connection with the transcendent, and then things like practice, hours and hours of sacrifice, practice, and that these things are becoming almost impossible for generations, a couple generations now, that have been so kind of addicted to stimulation and movement and entertainment that they can't take the time to kind of go deep in themselves to those sources of new creativity. This is my opinion, that the arts in general have been afflicted by this lack of rigor, lack of excellence and training. And the lack of excellence is another one. One of the problems in the church in music, it seems to me, is that we can't bring ourselves to say anything is ugly, right? Some songs are just bad. We're at a new parish out here in Virginia Beach, and they're lovely, and they have a great choir and a very talented choir director, but they're absolutely wasting themselves on terrible music written in the late 70s and early 80s in the church. They actually sang Kumbaya this past. And George is there. Here, hi, George. It's Barbara.
Hey, Barbara.
How are you? I'm sitting here riffing on the ugly music in the church, and I want to hear what you have to say about that, but how are you doing?
Doing good. Give me a hug.
I'm giving you a digital hug right now. Welcome. So I just did a long introduction of you and went through with my audience your amazing resume as a composer and as somebody involved in so many different, a diverse body of soundtracks. So we'll get there. But yeah, George, tell the audience how you got into music. So you were born in Seoul. Did your parents like send you to music school at a young age? How did you get into it?
Well, my dad took our family to see Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Pops at the Hollywood Bowl. And I was 7 years old when we went to that concert, and I was just completely blown away with the music. I, you know, as a 7-year old, I couldn't really quite understand it because, you know, it was the first time seeing, 40 piece orchestra up there, but it was so incredible. And that experience, just really stayed with me. And I knew that that's what I wanted to do. Somehow I wanted to be involved with that. You know, like I wasn't a musician. I just like, okay, that's incredible. I want to somehow figure this thing out. And then I started piano lessons when I was 10 and then switched various instruments. And I think by the time I was in high school, I was pretty much known as a bassist. And that's kind of when the whole new wave punk thing happened. So, yeah, along with my blue hair, I was actively performing in different bands. And, because we weren't the greatest musicians at that age, we were forced to write our own songs. Because whenever we try to cover another song, it just didn't turn out very well. So we're like, hey, we'll just write our own songs. We'll make it really simple, but at least, you know, it will sound good. And, and then we just got, you know, I got really involved in songwriting, you know, kind of like by that, you know, that way. So my parents are not musicians. However, my grandmother on my father's side was an opera singer. And, she kind of gave up that career to start a family. And but she would expose my dad to opera and would sing around the house. And, you know, my father became a huge Pavarotti fan, you know, obsessed. Like, he's the kind of person that would listen to opera and cry. So,
sure.
Yeah. So that was what was going on. But
so yeah, cool. Now, I so what opera. You just said there, there to the audience is that it's so important that parents expose their kids at a young age to the world of the arts, right? You know, whatever it is, because in many ways, kids, you know, how would they know that you could even be in a symphony if no one puts that in front of them early on, right? But that you could fall in love with it. You know, I remember my mother taking my sister and I to see classic movies on the big screen. And this was before video came out, right? You know, and that the Gone with the Wind would only come around like once a decade, you know, and so, but Mom wanted us to see some of these classic movies on the big screen, and that made us full of wonder, right? For these things. So it sounds like your parents did a similar thing for you there.
Yeah, definitely. They thought I would enjoy the experience. They were always playing records around the house, and records. You know, if your audience is pretty young, so what it was, you know, vinyl records. They would play records around the house and stuff. And you know, your kids. You know, if there's people are going to discover music one way or another, and why not, you know, take the lead and expose them to the stuff that you're passionate about. You know, because they're going to find it. If you don't introduce them to music, they're going to get introduced by other people. But at least you can present stuff that you know you feel that may have a bit more, you know, interesting or, you know, some with substance, you know, I mean, you know, why not present that?
Yeah. So George, you know, I was commenting before you came on about how it seems to me that in general, all of the arts have suffered in recent generations by a couple things. One is the lack of rigor. That young people, you know, they can't sit and quietly tap into that quiet place in them very readily. I see this in my film students, right? You know, they absolutely are hard pressed to contemplate a movie or a performance or anything. They need constant agitation and stimulation. And I think this is affecting all of the arts. The second thing that I think is affecting the arts is this just unwillingness to ever say anything is ugly, you know, or that doesn't work. Right? And so it seems to me that in the church, we're particularly afflicted with that. When we come back after the break, I'd love to have you comment on that, you know, and say, you know, what do you think the church, the music in the church and the church and the culture is right now? Do you have hope? Or how can it be better? Okay, so stay tuned, George. We'll come back in the next segment. And this is Barbara Nicolosi. We're on Church of the Masses on the Virgin Most Powerful Radio Network. Stay tuned.
Welcome, Daniel. You're on the line. What's on your mind, brother?
Hi, I just wanted to share a testimony about Virgin Most Powerful Radio. I had a buddy at work who, you know, he's a lukewarm Catholic guy, and I wanted him to start listening to the Terry and Jesse show, so I kept telling him to download the app, and he kept putting me off. So one day, I grabbed his phone, and I downloaded the app for him. I went on vacation, and you know, I kept telling him to listen to it. He was kind of put me off. I came back from vacation. He comes to my cubicle and he says to me, "Hey, man, I've been listening to Terry and Justin's show and it's great. And it's made a big impact in his life. The guy, he's going to weekly adoration a couple times a week. He goes to the mass in the morning. He's an on-fire Catholic and he promotes the Terry and Jesse show and the Virgin Most Powerful Radio."
Wow. Daniel, what a testimony. And I want to encourage our listeners to get those cards by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org and do what Daniel's doing. Go out and spread the faith by inviting people to listen to Virgin Most Powerful. Daniel, thanks for your testimony, brother. God love you.
You're welcome.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Church of the Masses with Barbara Nicolosi.
Hello again. Welcome back to Church of the Masses. I'm Barbara Nicolosi, and we are talking with my friend George Serra, extraordinary composer. And George, I had just posed a question right before the break. What do you think about the state of music in the church? You could even do the broader Christian world and then in the culture overall. What do you think? Where are we?
Well, I'll just be honest, right? I've been attending the traditional Latin Mass for several years now, you know. I'm a convert. You know, I became baptized, confirmed in 2006. So I started going to Latin Mass fairly early on, around 2008. And I think one of the things was I was already familiar with the music. However, I didn't know the music was written for the church. So I didn't know that. Like, I was a huge fan of Vivaldi, Schubert, all these, you know, great composers. And I was like, oh, wait, the Ave Maria is about the Virgin Mary. Like, I didn't know, like, any of these things, right? I'm not really big on the modern music. It's just, I think it could be done well, but I think because, you know, it's just, they're just getting whoever to go up there with a guitar and things and, you know, put their effort forward, that's great and stuff. But we have like this huge history of great music, and it just seems like people, you know, are ignoring it. That's just my take on it. I'm not personally a big fan of what I've been witnessing. I mean, I haven't been to the New Order Mass in a long time, so I'm not sure, but I know that while I was going through my RCIA process, I was going, and I just wasn't, that just, that wasn't something I was connecting to. However,
so as a professional musician, you weren't impressed with what you were finding in the church when you came in. So that's
no.
telling.
Yeah.
But George, how about in the broader culture? You know, where are we right now with music in the broader culture? What do you think?
I think there's a lot of really great music coming out. A lot of great instrumental music. There's a lot of new great classical music. It's called modern classical. That's what, you know, they termed it. And you hear it in a lot of film scores. People like Philip Glass and Clint Mansell and all these people are doing it. I'm hearing, Max Richter is another guy. And, you know, he just did his take on Vivaldi's Four Seasons, and he did it very respectfully. He added a little bit of electronic elements to it, but for most part, it's really, you know, it's true to the original. So I think there's a lot of good music coming out and stuff. It's just not being heard on pop radio. But I think now we have so many different ways of discovering music, whether it be streaming services or YouTube or SoundCloud. And, you know, it's out there. And so I listen a lot to college radio. And I go onto a site called TuneIn Radio, and you could pretty much listen to any college radio around the country. So I'm listening to college stations in Austin and, you know, Milwaukee and Berkeley, wherever, and LA too. And it's just making a note of the DJs and, you know, who's coming on when. And because I love searching out and discovering new music. I'm still like a little kid when it comes to that. I get very excited when I discover a new band or a new artist.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Now, George, I know you've done a lot of score work. You've done a lot of work for visual media in different ways. What is the challenge of scoring a movie or a television show? What do people not know about doing that?
For me, it's who's ever, if it's the director or the editor, usually who's bringing a composer on, they need to get familiar with the person they're bringing on. It's because with music, everyone has kind of their own style, a little bit of a signature. I mean, you could kind of curtail it to a certain thing, but for the most part, if you hire someone, I mean, if you hire Phil Glass, you're going to get arpeggios no matter what. Yeah. If you hire Trent Reznor, you're going to get dark, melancholic, ambient music. And those people that do hire these artists and composers, like, they know off the bat, a lot of filmmakers are a fan of a particular composer, and they work with them. I mean, Tim Burton, Danny Elfman, you know, that's a great example where, you know, they work together. So it's when you meet someone who has no idea what your music sounds like, the stuff that you've been recording, and they kind of don't have an idea what they want, that's always typical. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and now I just, when I work on a project, you know, I tell them, I like, look, you know, you need to get familiar with what I do. And, you know, that you only get one revision per scene. I'm sorry, I just can't go in that circle. Like, you know, if someone's crying and something, you know, in a car, uh-huh. you know, there's only like really a few ways that's going to go, you know? And,
okay, yeah.
And so I think it's having the filmmaker be confident enough in their work. And their composer work. So it's a little bit of research, just like I wouldn't hire like a violinist, you know, if I've never heard them play, you know, I would at least have them audition or something. Yeah.
Right.
So
right.
Uh-huh. I think it's doing a lot of legwork and homework.
So I spoke a little bit about your work in rescoring The Passion of Joan of Arc. So I know you've taken that on the road. Do you have any, like, what projects are you working on right now? And is there a way people could hear your music, how you could kind of direct them to listen to some of your stuff?
I guess my Facebook page, you know, George Serra Music would be a good place. I do post stuff up there. And, like, next week I'll be in Iowa City performing The Passion of Joan of Arc there. And I've been going like every other weekend, flying to a different city, performing that. I did finish a feature film that's still in post-production, so that hasn't come out yet. And that's, you know, I think, you know, he's obviously a friend of yours.
What movie is that?
And it's called Her Name is Joe. And I finished that. That's in post-production. And so everything, the music's been turned, I think they're just editing it and, you know, trying to refine the final version.
Cool. Who's producing that, George? Did you say somebody I know?
I think it's Joe's dad.
Oh, okay. All right. Whatever.
Like
So tell us a little bit about The Passion of Joan of Arc. What is it about that movie that that made you want to just rescore it? Because it's become such a thing now. You know, you're drawing all over the place with it. What is it about that movie?
Well, I think before I worked on the music, I read Joan's biography, and I was just really, you know, taken by her life. But also, there's been so many misconceptions about Joan of Arc that you know, I just really wanted to do something that I felt like if she was alive and she heard it, she would at least, you know, obviously the modern element would be like maybe freaking her out, but at least something where she would really, you know, give her a thumbs up, because all the what the choir is singing is all in Latin, and it's the prayers from the three saints that she had apparitions from: Saint Michael, Saint Catherine of Alexandria, Saint Margaret of Antioch. So I did the research, found the traditional prayers, made sure it was all in Latin, and you know, and that's kind of what the choir singing, because it's the last 2 hours of her life. And I really felt like that's probably what was going on. She was probably saying the St. Michael prayer. She was probably saying the Hail Mary. So I have these things coming in and out of the film at specific points. So I just really wanted to do something that I felt was like, okay, I really wanted to portray, you know, to my best ability, you know, an honest portrayal of like what she was feeling. So it wasn't so much a score and scoring the movie, because it is just like, you know, majority of it is just close-ups of faces and things like that. But it was like what she was feeling inside. That's what I really wanted to transcend to the audience, you know, so mm-hmm. that you were kind of inside, you know, inside her mind as these prayers were going on in Latin, because I knew that she was singing them in Latin. back in those days, you know, she knew it. Even though she couldn't read, she knew how to speak and understand Latin because she worked with a daily master. So, so that was kind of like what I wanted to portray. And, of course, there's electronic elements in there, and there's my take on it, and there's some instrumental pieces that flow in and out. But it was just, really wanted to create a vibe that you were, like, kind of with her, you know, in that sense.
Yeah. Let me say, if people haven't seen the film by Carl Dreyer, The Passion of Joan of Arc, you're definitely in for a treat. And it's a very odd movie in that the actress who plays the lead and who the camera is about 10 inches off her nose for a lot of the movie. She was not a professional actress. Carl Dreyer found her just out there, and he just thought she looked embodied what he thought Joan of Arc would have looked like, and then he gave her direction, and she took it astoundingly. But this is a very intimate movie because it's so many close-ups, so many tight close-ups, and so now you have a new reason to look at it, George's score to go along with the film. But yeah, it's one of the classics of silent cinema, and probably in some people's minds, one of the greatest saint lives that's ever been done. I mean, would you agree with that, George?
Yeah, absolutely. The biography I read was by an author named John K. Beavers. And I got that book because I consulted a friend of mine who at the time was teaching at Loyola Marymount University as a professor there. And I asked him, okay, what do you think would, you know, the best book on St. Joan of Arc? And he mentioned two, and one of them was the John K. Beavers one. And I read that and I was just like, yeah. So I think reading that book also would be really good to get a good understanding of Joan. And like, you know, there's like so many misconceptions about her that are out there that I think this book is just, would really, you know, like she was truly a saint and truly, you know, a humble person who just, you know, and after reading it, it's like undeniable that, okay, this person was hearing, you know, and communicating with the saints and God and was, you know, amazing book. I recommend that and the film as well. Yeah.
Sure. So, George, we only have 20 seconds here, but, you know, I really want to thank you for the work that you do. You know, I love that you're not just saying everything has to be old to be beautiful. So, chops for you. And everybody, stay tuned. Go to George's Facebook page. And meanwhile, stay tuned. We're going to review the movie Harriet. This is Barbara Nicolosi on Church of the Past.
Welcome to our January 11th, 2020 Spiritual Warfare Conference. Every year without fail, this is our most popular, well-attended event. This year's Spiritual Warfare Conference will host Adam Bly, a Catholic demonologist and an auxiliary member of the International Association of Exorcists, along with Dr. Luis Sandoval, a psychiatrist who's part of the Healing, Deliverance, and Exorcism team for the Diocese of Orange. These two gentlemen bring tons of experience and expertise in the area of spiritual warfare. This is going to be a high-information Catholic seminar. I'll be there as well, sharing some riveting stories on the diabolical and liberation found through Jesus Christ from my best-selling book, The Devil in the City of Angels. Mark your calendars, come and join us, and meet other radio hosts from Jesus 911. Contrary to popular belief, spiritual warfare is not demon-centered. It's Christ-centered. Come join us and learn how to armor up and fight the good fight of faith. Catholics, wake up. Don't hit the snooze button. Join us at St. Christopher Catholic Church, 629 South Glendora Avenue, Escovina, California, on January 11, 2020. See you then. Strength and honor in Jesus' name.
Sirach 11:24 says, "Do not say, I am self-sufficient. What harm can come to me now?" According to St. Catherine of Siena, presumption is like vermin burrowing at the root of the tree of our soul. If we do not uproot it with great care and humility, it will eventually destroy the soul. May God keep us from all presumption of mind and heart, and realize that we depend on Him for everything.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Church of the Masses with Barbara Nicolosi.
And hello, and welcome back to Church of the Masses. So here we are. I'm here with my student, Riley Garrido, and this is my new thing. Here we go. My new thing is to review movies with the member of the up-and-coming generation to hear from them what they think is good. And, oh, there we go. We're going to have half my head in the picture or not. I don't know. They're moving it on the their ends, too. So the movie we're looking at today is Harriet. Harriet is the movie now in theaters about Harriet Tubman that stars Cynthia Erivo in the title role. There's a few other, huge stars in the movie. Leslie Odom Jr., Vanessa Calloway. Yeah, there's really not any other major stars in this film, but kind of a surprising, what's that, Jennifer Nettles showed up in the movie, the singer from, she's a kind of country music singer. So I was very surprised by this movie, but I wanted to hear, so what I do, just introduce Riley, and he's a film student here at Regent. So Riley, you grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina. Why did you want to be a film student?
I've always been fascinated more with documentary side of things, but storytelling has always been interesting for me. I've, since I was 11, been doing stop motion animation. So claymation, like Wallace and Gromit, that type of stuff. And so I've been doing that for a number of years, and it just seemed like the right thing to go into when coming to Regent. So I'm trying to figure out what that looks like long term, but I've always been interested with the storytelling as well as just getting my hands on it, and that's one reason why I liked stop motion, was more hands-on with the storytelling.
And Regent has an amazing animation department. I think that of all of the different sections, it's probably the most complete faculty, most potential there. So Regent has an impressive $52 million film production building here, but the animation here is no slouch if you want to go into that. Very good. So let's plunge into Harriet. Why don't you tell them, Riley, just give them a quick sketch of what the story is, and then we'll start talking about what we think, how they did.
So the main plot of the movie Harriet is about Harriet Tubman, who's a slave in Maryland in 1849. She gets married to a free black man. They realize that she cannot become free, and so she decides to run away. And so she escapes up into Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which at that time is a free state, and she wants to go back and rescue others from her family as well as those that she knew back on the plantation that she was from. So she makes a couple trips going back across the border into the south, bringing slaves north. Eventually she brings 70 slaves and frees them. Once the Fugitive Slave Act is passed, however, instead of just having to stop in Philadelphia, which was 100 miles from where she was, she has to go all the way up into Canada, outside of the United States. And so it makes the trek longer and a little more difficult, but not impossible. Mm-hmm. And so what we follow throughout the movie is her going through and freeing slaves, and as well as seeing the process that she goes through in building the stature of being the Moses of the slaves.
Yeah, so Moses is the name that she takes, and it kind of points to I was totally surprised by the faith aspect in this movie, considering this was not coming from any kind of Christian group. This is not a Christian production company. mainstream all the way, and yet they really don't play down her Christian faith at all.
No, they don't.
Very surprising. They let her motivation is, she literally has visions of from God all through the film, and God will speak to her, and she talks about that. And says, yeah, God told me this, right? When I first started talking to God, he let me know. I was really surprised by that, weren't you?
Yeah, it did catch me off guard a little bit. And doing a little bit of digging after watching the movie, it's really historically accurate for the they slightly tweak the occasional thing, but it really doesn't change the event itself, which is really fascinating. And
And they have a great image in the movie of God as a tree. So there's this huge tree that is just very sturdy and rooted by, it looks like by the water, and that becomes for her God. Like, you know, it's not that the tree is God, but it represents God in a beautiful way, and she talks to it quite a bit and when she's talking to God, which is I thought was a lovely image, because such a strong, powerful image. But so she takes the name Moses because Moses led his people out of slavery and into freedom. And there's also a whole bunch of coming out of the water stuff. So and there's a beautiful scene where she first really is tested leading the slaves, where she goes into the water and just makes an act of, you know, prayer and faith, and then comes out of the water, and all the slaves follow her. It's really, I thought, beautifully done. And so the Moses name takes hold. But okay, so what did you think? I mean, I thought for a biopic, it was surprising. It was wasn't cynical. I thought it was pretty beautifully done. But what did you think?
I think they did a great job with the movie. I didn't necessarily know what to expect from it. I did know a decent amount of history on Harriet Tubman already, so it was neat to see them put that on the screen as well. And so it was, I didn't feel as brought into it, probably because I knew so much about Tubman already. That's my take on it. But it was a powerful representation of her life, spanning from not only of just her freeing slaves, but then also leading into her involvement in the Civil War a little bit. We get a little taste of that.
Yeah, I'm kind of amazing. Who knew that she led a regiment of black soldiers on a raid in South Carolina? Mm-hmm. I mean, I was like, who knew about that? Yeah. So there's been some controversy associated with the film, because the film does include a depiction of a black bounty hunter who is helping return slaves to their masters. What do you think about that controversy?
It's again, doing my research on it, it's not, it did happen with slaves and whatnot, and them being caught by free black men. It didn't happen as often than not, so the chance of that happening was not that big, but it wasn't wrong for that to be an option for the movie. And so it definitely makes it interesting perspective of showing the contrast between, okay, you have black slaves, but then also you have free black men that are also helping catch slaves. But then also on the same side, you have the white slaveholders, but then also you have the white abolitionists. So it was a good contrast of showing the difference between the free and the enslaved, and, you know, just how the mindset was different in the different sides. And so for the free black men that was being the bounty hunter, you could make a good living off of catching slaves. You catch one or two slaves, earn about $400. You have enough to own a farm and then also be able to take care of yourself for basically the rest of your life in that time frame. And so while you may not be high up on the totem pole and how you're treated in society, you were pretty well set if you did have that kind of money of a few hundred dollars.
I didn't have a problem with it either, and I can't believe that that's we're not allowed to show history if it doesn't jive with the contemporary political correct view, right? You know, so I have no interest in that. But how about the production values in the film? You know, they don't, you know, it's a period piece, but they shoot a lot outside. They shoot a lot where they don't have to build buildings. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's a few scenes of Philadelphia, but for the most part, they kind of hide their small budget. Did that bother you, or did you think it was okay?
I didn't really notice it too much. Mm-hmm. It definitely made sense why they had a lot of woods shots. The only part where I noticed that the budget was lacking a little bit was the first scene of Philadelphia. Because mm-hmm. When they're doing a little sweeping shot, you see Independence Hall, but it's kind of obvious that it's not the actual Independence Hall, which is understandable for Philadelphia today. Mm-hmm. But it's just, you see this giant fence and then Independence Hall in the background, and you can kind of tell that it's, they didn't have enough money to really make it look legitimate.
Right.
But aside from that, I really didn't.
I didn't bother you. Yeah. And how about the lack of major stars? Like they didn't cast where they didn't spend their money on that. Mm-hmm. You know, the talent they had, did that bother you? Did you feel the performances were uneven at all, or what? Like, for example, for me, I thought Jennifer Nettles was miscast as she plays the mother of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And quite, like, her name of her band, Sugarland, that's it, Sugarland. Ah, that drives me crazy. So, yeah, she's like huge, huge star, country star with Sugarland.
Yeah.
And she sings on the soundtrack for the movie, so they gave her a role. But I think she probably must have put some money into it, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, it's not like she has that much screen time, but I felt like she was just kind of a little phony. I also didn't really like her son that look kind of rugged, make it look effeminate. It didn't work for me that much. I didn't think he was that great an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked a lot of the other performances that were there. And so it didn't really stand out for me as being uneven in the performances. And, of course, her performance in the lead is the one you're watching most, and I think she did a really good job. What about you?
Yeah, I think that they cast Harriet really well. I can definitely see what you were discussing before with the slave owners and her son. I know that I can't remember his name, but who they cast as her son was apparently I was reading some reviews of like the director, and they were saying that he's really nice offset, which is understandable. You want to have nice cast members, he just doesn't. I feel like the way that they portrayed him was a little as if he wants to feel attached to Harriet, but then isn't at the same time, and it feels conflicting when it shouldn't be.
His name is Joe Alwyn, and he is a British actor, and I'm going to say, again, doesn't really have any major credits at all that you would know him by. I think Harriet is going to be his biggest project, but yeah, it's just kind of an odd to me. I don't really know what he was, you know, he didn't impress me that much. But,
yeah.
But how about, I thought the score was beautiful. Mm. And they build the score around the Negro spirituals of the day. And then there's a few new songs. Carole King has one. I'm sure Jennifer Nettles has one too. Mm. But I loved the way they use the Negro spirituals as they really build them into the plot.
Yes. And especially there's one part where they actually throw into more of the score itself behind the spiritual itself. Instead of just hearing the slave singing the spirituals, you throw in more of the music itself behind the spiritual, which emphasized it, which they did a wonderful job with that.
Wonderful. And I just realized we have a hard stop. So this is Barbara Nicolosi, and stay tuned for Church of the Masses next week. Thank you.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio. sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.